This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, the Spanish actor Javier Bardem, won an Oscar for his performance as a psychopathic serial killer in the 2007 Coen Brothers film No Country for Old Men. He played a seductive Spanish artist in the Woody Allen film Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Bardem has been a respected actor in international cinema for years. He's earned 7 nominations for the Goya, known as the Spanish Oscars, and he's won 4 times. His films include Live Flesh, Before Night Falls, and The Sea Inside. He's earned his 3rd Academy Award nomination for his performance in the new film Beautiful by Mexican director Alejandro González Iñárritu. It's nominated for Best Foreign Film. In Beautiful, Bardem plays a small-time criminal in Barcelona who runs a crew of African immigrants selling knockoff goods on the street. He also has connections to a sweatshop of illegal Chinese immigrants. But he's a loving and attentive father to his 2 children. Their mother, his wife, suffers from bipolar disorder. And on top of it all, he learns that he has a life-threatening illness. Javier Bardem spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Javier Bardem, welcome to Fresh Air. You really carry this film. This film is really about your character, Uxbal. And he is a really rich and complex character. I read that when you read the script that you felt you really connected with this guy.
Yes, I think as in life, most of us, we do right and wrong 15 times per day in the same day. So what I mean is I believe in contradiction. I believe that the world is not black and white. And that's why I like to portray characters like these, which is there's a human being there going through a lot of conflicts and contradictions, and that is not easy to read at the first moment. But as we go along and see the movie, we understand better who he is, and we care for him. And that's what I like about Uxbal, my character. You have to create a normal person under extreme circumstances, and that's always, challenging, because you don't have a stereotype to create. You have to really go to the bottom of the heart of this man and try to live with him for 5 months, which is what the whole shoot lasts. What I mean by this is, yes, it was very challenging, and I was scared to death to do it, but I thought it was going to be a very rewarding experience, which it was, not only at a professional level, but also at personal level.
Yeah, and why at a personal level?
Because you have to face yourself. It's impossible to do a character like this from the outside. It's impossible to be 5 months, almost 12 to 14 hours per day, 6 days per week, submerged in this emotional state and not be affected. So you're affected by it in a way that it's like you're putting a mirror in front of you and you are watching the things that you don't like about yourself or that you are afraid to look within yourself, like death. Then you have to really be able to overcome yourself and be him, be that person, rather than getting stuck in your own fears, on your own needs, on your own ghosts. You have to really transcend that and be somebody else. And that's also very rewarding because, as we know, we need some vacation of ourselves. we need to take some holidays from ourselves. So, but in this case, it was not easy because when you jumped into this fiction, this man, you realize how hard that must be to be this person. And I met people like him, and I know they are real, and I know that they are walking around the streets.
Right. And this character, I don't want to give away the whole story, but he's under enormous pressures with his kids and with the little criminal enterprises and things that go wrong with him, some of them quite terribly wrong, and then his own very serious health issues. Did you find as you went through this 5 months of inhabiting this guy that it affected your relationships with other people at all? Did you
yes.
become a different person?
Totally, yes. When I was doing No Country for Old Men, and I was wearing that weird haircut and that cattle gun killing people.
Right.
I was shooting in New Mexico and in Texas, and the crew was fantastic. The Coens are the greatest, and Josh Brolin, which is a good friend of mine, really helped me to have a good laugh. But still, I felt isolated. I felt I didn't belong to that world because it was my first time when I was working with a whole foreign crew. I was the only one speaking Spanish. I was in the heartland, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I felt totally out of place. But that was not the only reason why I felt like that way. In a way, unconsciously, my character was putting me there, which is to be in a place where you don't belong to anywhere, you don't belong to anyone. You are isolated. You are by yourself. And that happened unconsciously. And in Beautiful, it happened the same. When you are portraying somebody and that has a very, a very specific weight, emotional weight, you feel like you're starting to really, to abandon your own body and go to someplace else. And then when you come back to yourself, people that know you well, family and friends, they know. It's like, why do you say that? Or why are you doing this? Or why are you behaving this way? You are not like that. But you, yourself, you don't realize because it's so unconsciously. It's so unconscious that you don't have control over it.
Yeah. Can you think of an example of what you just described, having an interaction and someone says, hey, that doesn't seem like you?
Well, I start to feel very anxious. I start to feel very, like, in a rush. Like, I have to close things in my life. Not important things. I'm not speaking about important things. But, like, for example, my refrigerator at home was not working, and I felt like it has to be fixed immediately. And sometimes I won't care that much. I will call the guy to try to fix it, and if he doesn't show up tomorrow or in 2 days, I won't get mad. And I got mad because I need the things to be done now, which is in a way what happened to him because he has a limited time. So
right, there's a sense of urgency about every
exactly.
day.
Exactly. So,
right.
And like that, a lot of things happen. And it's funny because I'm not like that way at all.
Now, to the director, the Mexican Alejandro González Iñárritu, I know that you and he were friends before this, and he wrote this part with you in mind in part, and he describes himself as a perfectionist. And this is hard to believe, but I read the scene in which you talk to your doctor and your doctor informs you that you have cancer, your character. I read that you took 50 takes of that scene. Is that right?
I don't know if 50, but a lot. He likes to shoot, and which that explains why he's, I would say he's the best actor director I ever met. Hmm. And why is that? Well, besides shooting 50 takes, which is very exhausting for everybody, it's about putting the camera in the right way, in the right place, at the right moment, and letting the actor breathe, and letting the actor to take the time to take the journey. Yes, he shoot, I don't know if he's 50, but he shoot like 30, and it was very exhausting. But we both go to a place where we want to give the best of ourselves, and that's why we went through this journey together until the very end.
A lot of people saw you in Vicky Cristie Barcelona, a romantic comedy in which Barcelona looks just terrific. I mean, the sun shines and the scenery is beautiful and the sea is glistening. In this film, Beautiful, there's a very different side of Barcelona. Do you want to describe a little bit some of the neighborhoods that this takes place in?
Yes. This Barcelona is more the Barcelona of people and communities that are full of people that are coming from outside of Spain. It's more of a landscape of immigration. And it's around in the exterior neighborhoods out of the town. But also, in the middle of the town, there are many places where you can walk through these major and very famous shops. And two doors down the street, there is a big building full of people that are trying to survive there. But basically most of it happens out of the Barcelona that we know, which is the Barcelona that it was portrayed in Woody Allen's movie, which, by the way, is a beautiful Barcelona. But as any other town in the world, it has two faces.
Well, we have to talk about No Country for Old Men, the Coen brothers' film, where you play Anton Chigurh, this truly scary sociopathic killer. First of all, just explain how you got the look of this guy.
Well, Tommy Lee Jones brought a book, a photo book, of photos that were taken in the frontier with No Mexico. And there was this guy who was in the photo. It was a kind of a black and white photo with a prostitute in a brothel in the frontier. And Joel and Ethan Coen brought that picture to me and they said, we want this. And the photo actually was very blurry. And I said, I don't know what you mean. I said, you'll know. You'll know soon. So they put me in the hair, in the makeup and hair trailer. And the hairdresser, which is a great, great man, he did this horrible haircut on my hair, with my hair. And there was no mirror. So I turned and I looked at them and they were laughing so hard that one of them fell off on the floor. Ha, 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 ha. And I said, I need a mirror. I need a mirror right now. What's going on here? And I saw it, and it was like, wow, that's really insane. But again, it's Coen Brothers. It's so brilliant idea. I mean, it's so brilliant. I mean, I knew that they gave me 50% of my character with that haircut. It was their idea.
Right. And for people who haven't seen it, it's you have long hair. It's not particularly stylish. A.O. Scott of the New York Times called it the lost beetle from hell.
that's a good one.
Right. So let's hear just a little bit of you in this character. We have a clip here from the film. And for those who haven't seen it, the plot involves there was a bunch of drug dealers and there was a shootout. And this guy who happens to be a welder, who's played by Josh Brolin, comes upon a satchel full of drug money and is running. And your character, Anton Chigurh, is trying to track him down. And what we're going to listen to is a phone call between you and this guy who has the money. And one of the things that is referred to in the call is that you know where his wife lives and is headed to Odessa, Texas, and the clear intimation is that, that you will kill his wife if he doesn't bring you the money. So let's just listen to this conversation. This is our guest Javier Bardem and Josh Brolin in No Country for Old Men.
You need to come see me.
Who is this?
You know who it is. You need to talk to me.
I don't need to talk to you.
I think you do. Do you know where I'm going?
Why would I care where you're going?
I know where you are.
Yeah, where am I?
You're in the hospital across the river, but that's not where I'm going. Do you know where I'm going?
Yeah, I know where you're going.
All right.
You know she won't be there.
It doesn't make any difference where she is.
So what are you going up there for?
You know how this is going to turn out, don't you?
Nope.
I think you do. So this is what I'll offer. You bring me the money and I'll let her go. Otherwise, she's accountable. The same as you. That's the best deal you're going to get. I won't tell you you can save yourself, because you can't.
And that's one of the 10 scariest guys I've ever seen in a movie. That's our guest, Javier Bardem, from the film, the Coen Brothers film, No Country for Old Men. You know, your character, Anton Chigurh, we don't really know anything about him in the film. And I gather in the novel, the Cormac McCarthy novel, he's also not so clearly defined. Mm-hmm. Did you have a backstory in your head that told you how he became what he was?
That's a very funny and very interesting question. No, I didn't. And actually, that's one of the things that I love to do the most, to create a story, a backstory in my head that will help me to understand what I'm doing. But in this case, I've prepared the role with my acting teacher, Juan Carlos Coraza, which has been my acting teacher since 22 years ago. And of course, when I go there with Juan Carlos, with my acting teacher, I go based on the ideas that the Coens want me to do. It's not something that he will direct me how to do it and then I will go to the set and do what I want. No. It's like, I talk to the directors, they tell me what they want, I go there to the laboratory, try different things, come back to them, and they choose what they want. And I was working with Juan Carlos, and we found, like, there is no way there's backstory. And that's the great thing. He is not a human being. There is no backstory. He is a symbol. He is a symbolic idea of violence. He is a man that comes out of nowhere and goes to nowhere at the end. So he's death himself. He's violence himself. And that's why we wanted to create this thing where you are not sure what is him, if he's a man or a machine or a biblical plague or what. And that was funny to do, but also very delicate to not transpass the line. And in that, the Coens had a lot to say because they were directing me on the set in a very, very, very subtle way, but also without losing the sense of humor.
Sense of humor, huh?
Yeah, that look, that way of walking, that way of throwing one line here and there, that's something that the Coens were, they were pushing me, not pushing me, like asking me to do. And sometimes I will go like, why, you don't need that. You don't need, why would he do that? And they were laughing. And they said, you'll know when you see the movie. And they are damn right. I mean, it's one of the great things about the Coens is that they never forget the sense of humor.
Can you think of an example of one of those things that you said, why do you want me to do that? And then it made sense later?
I don't know. There's a scene where I go to the trailer park and I ask for Josh Brolin's character, and there's this woman there. And then I ask where he is, and she says, I cannot give any information. And then I naturally look at her, and I went away. And they said, no, you look at her, and you stay there for 2 minutes. And I was like, what? Yes, we want you to look at her and stare at her for 2 minutes. I mean, without blinking. I said, okay, I'll do that. And I thought at the moment it was a little bit too forced, you know, too pushy. But no, they knew exactly. And that's one of the moments where I think and I know people laugh the most with that look. So those are the things that the Coens know how to do the best.
Yeah, I remember that scene too. And she says, sir, we can't give out no information.
Exactly.
You stare right back at her.
Exactly.
Earlier you were talking about reading the script for Beautiful and that you connected with this guy who was rich and complex. The character Anton Chigurh in No Country for Old Men is not really a human being. Did you connect with him in any way? Or no.
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 And, first of all,
that's reassuring, I guess.
yes, thank God. I went to the Coens, and which I've always dreamed of working with, and I never thought it was going to happen. And it happened. And I went to him and to them, and I said, listen, I cannot do this movie. I can't. I don't drive. I don't speak English, and I hate violence. And they said, you're perfect. You're perfect for the movie. I said, okay, whatever. So they convinced me, and I went there, and I was so lost. There's nothing too much, and there's not much to hold on to, because as we are talking, as we said, it's an idea rather than a human being. But then there was a moment where I finally got the rhythm of his, and I felt comfortable. And as I said, the Coens were always, helping me in finding the tone, in finding the humor in it. And that's why I had a great time doing it. Otherwise, it would have been too dark. And it is too dark. It is very dark. But he also has these glimpses of humor that make the whole thing, more easy for me.
You know, you've had this long career of really interesting, complex roles in your international work. And, you know, millions of Americans really sort of got to know you through No Country for Old Men. Mm-hmm. Is it weird for you to be introduced to a lot of American audiences as this creepy guy?
No, it's a pleasure. I mean, that makes people have a second thought when they want to come and say hello.
Yeah.
No, it's like, no, it was, I, first of all, I never expect this movie to be the movie that it is. I mean, because as you know, we don't interact. We didn't ever interact, me and Josh Brolin or Tommy Lee Jones. So I was only aware of what I was doing on the set, which was walking around with that haircut and killing people with my cattle gun. So I didn't really know what movie we were doing. Then when I saw it, I felt, wow, this is something crazy and insane, but it's very Coen Brothers. I love it. And then the movie went to this huge high place, and but you never know. You never know how it's going to be received.
You come from a long line of actors. Your mom, mm-hmm. right? Your grandparents, mm-hmm. your brother, your sister. When you were a kid, did you see yourself becoming going into the profession?
Not really. I actually wanted to go to the opposite direction because I was so used to see all of this in my daily life that there was no magic in it for me. I was not really intrigued about what that was. So I start to, well, I study as the kid, and then I start to work as a painter, and I went to Bellas Artes to paint. But little by little, I got into the movies by doing some work as an extra so I could get some money and keep on painting. And one day they offered me this couple of lines, and I said, well, why not? And I did it, and I felt great. I felt like, wow, I know this place. I belong here. And then I start to study as an actor. I went to my acting school, which is the one that I'm still going, because I think it helps me a lot to really remind myself, why do I love what I do? Because sometimes you get lost. Sometimes you are like, is this worth it? What am I doing this? Am I doing this for the right reasons? Blah, blah, blah. So coming back to the acting school helps me to really put myself in the old shoes. Mm-hmm. And then one day they gave me this role where I have to speak more than two lines, and I prepare myself, and I enjoy it. And I guess from that moment to today, I've been very lucky, very, very lucky and very blessed by working with some of the greatest directors I ever dream of.
Well, I mean, you certainly had success at it. I mean, you won the Goya Award for Best Actor for the film Boca a Boca. That's, mm-hmm. I guess, what people call the Spanish Oscars, right? Sort of the leading film award. And you became a really leading actor in Spanish cinema. Did you aspire to act in English then at all?
Well, I'm 42 years old, so I guess my generation, we all grew up with Taxi Driver and Apocalypse Now and great performances done in English, along with some of the great performers also in Italy, France, and of course Spain, which mm-hmm. I have the chance to work with some of them. But I never thought about going out of Spain and working in a foreign language ever, because that was totally out of my my radar, no? It's like, no, that's not going to happen. But it happened. That's the weird thing. And if you ask me why, I can tell you. There is this lovely man called Julian Schnabel, which uh-huh. I love and I adore, who had the guts to say, I want you to do Before Night Falls. And everybody around was like, why, who's that guy? Why him? And he said, well, because I like him, because he saw some of my movies in Spain. At that time, I didn't speak any English. And he said, we're going to make this together. Don't worry, it's going to be fine. And I have one of the best experiences of my life doing that movie. I will never forget it. And we worked hard and we made it. And I guess that brought some attention.
You really didn't speak English before getting into that movie?
No, I mean, yes, hello, and give me a glass of water. That's uh-huh. all. I'm always saying that I know how to curse very well because I've learned English listening to AC/DC. Okay. So I'm a huge fan of AC/DC, and so I was translating the lyrics, so I know how to curse.
You have to start somewhere, right?
Exactly.
Well, we should just pause a minute on this film because it was a real important one for you. Before Night Falls, directed by Julian Schnabel, it's you play the poet and novelist Reynaldo Arena, who mm-hmm. was a gay man persecuted in Cuba during the revolution. It kind of takes us through the 60s, through the Mariel boat lift, when his character ends up in New York and gets AIDS. I mean, it's a mm-hmm. it's a really dramatic role. And one of the things that's fascinating to me about it is that it takes place in Cuba, but much of the dialogue is in English. How is acting in English different from acting in Spanish for you?
It's a totally different situation. And it's like here, I'm trying to express myself and share some opinions and be relaxed and giving you what I think, giving you some thoughts about what I feel or what I think. And there is this office in my brain full of people working at the same time that I'm talking to you, trying to not, be wrong with the intonation, with the words. So it's very exhausting.
The office is translating, because, right? Okay.
Exactly. If I speak Spanish, that office is closed. There's nobody in the office. I mean, I'm fine by my own.
Right.
Funny enough, and that's something that I discovered during Before Night Falls, it gives me also a different kind of freedom, because I don't know how to say it. It's not about not having respect to the words. Of course I have respect to the words. But since some of the words doesn't have an emotional resonance on me, I can play with them more freely. When if you're speaking in your mother tongue, you may be more cautious of using some words or using some intonations. In English, I feel more free also to try and experiment things and experiment tones and the way of speaking. So one thing gives you the other.
Oh, that's interesting. I also thought we should talk a little about the film The Sea Inside, Mar Adentro, mm-hmm. which you also won the Goya Best Actor Award for. And it's based on the true story of Ramon Sampedro, who was a middle-aged man who had spent more than 20 years as a quadriplegic. He'd had a diving accident, seeking the legal right to die, to have assisted suicide. When you tell that story, it's not necessarily the kind of story that people might choose for a Saturday night movie, but it really is a terrific movie and a remarkable performance. You're heavier, you're bald, balding, and you're pinned to a bed. I mean, you can move yourself only from the neck. Talk a little about the physical transformation of that character.
That was a great story that I was once again scared to do. And I guess those are the ones that are worth to do, the ones that make you fear, the ones that gives you fear to do, because those are the ones that has a meaning to yourself. And this one was especially scary because this man was almost 50 years or more than 50 years when he died, and I was 34 when they offered me. So we had a long process of trying to become that person through makeup and through, I don't know, physicality. And then we found it. And once we found it, it was one of the greatest experiences, believe it or not. And yes, it was on the bed every day, which is a good thing, no? I mean, it's a great job to be on the bed all day. But also Alejandro Amenábar, which is the director, which is an amazing director, a great, great person, great sense of humor. We were having a blast doing that movie, and everybody thought, like, oh, that must be very hard to do. No, actually, it was fun. And once again, I have to be every day, like, for 5 to 6 hours on the makeup trailer to have the amazing makeup that Joe Allen, the makeup artist, did with me. That was 5 to 6 hours every day lying down, and you cannot move because it's all on the face. Well, after a week, I understood perfectly what it's like to be on the bed, confined, without moving, because I guess I found the key of my role in that makeup chair when I couldn't even move or go to toilet, because I have to be still for that makeup to take place on my face. And those are the things that you are not controlling and that can give you a lot of help. And beyond that, this character made an amazing bet for life, actually, for a dignified life. And I think it is a great honor for me to have been in his skin for 3 months.
Yeah. I mean, one of the fascinating things about the character is that it's not a story of constant suffering. I mean, he has relationships with people around him, and they're complicated. He smiles a lot, even when he talks about difficult things, which is a fascinating thing about him, I think. Was it a controversial film? And the case was certainly controversial. I mean, did you feel comfortable with sort of the political issues that it was raising?
Yeah, I felt comfortable, and I was so much into what he meant to a lot of people, because that's the story, that's the point. The point is, he was a very, a smiley and fun person who was making fun of everybody, including himself, who had a big appetite for life, but coming to his own terms, that wasn't enough for him. And what he was doing is to put people, to challenge people to understand that, like, who owns my life? I own my life. And if all of this is not enough for me, who should tell me that I should keep on living? And that's a very powerful statement. And yes, the movie came out when he did that, when he took his life. Of course, it brought a lot of, attention to euthanasia in Spain. And of course, it's very, very complex matter. I mean, it's not that easy. But there are certain cases, like Ramón San Pedro, which is very obvious. And still, he had to fight so long and so strong until he found his own way to do it.
You got to work with Woody Allen on Vicky Cristina Barcelona. How did you get that role?
Well, I had a call from Mr. Woody Allen, which I was very impressed by. He told me briefly, I have a script for you, I want you to read it, and he hung up. And I said, okay, whatever. And then I read it, and I thought it was fun, and it was very, very, smart, because it's about the stereotypes and the people behind those stereotypes. And then he called me back and said, do you like it? I said, yes, okay, you are on. It was that easy.
So let's listen to a clip. This is a moment early in the film. You play this romantic painter, Juan Antonio, who approaches these two young American women who are in Barcelona, played here by Rebecca Hall and Scarlett Johansson, and make a pretty forward proposal. Let's listen.
American?
I'm Christina, and this is my friend Vicky.
What color are your eyes?
They're blue.
I'd like to invite you both to come with me to Oviedo.
To come where?
To Oviedo. For the weekend. We leave in 1 hour.
What? Where is Oviedo?
A very short flight.
By plane?
Mm-hmm.
What's in Oviedo?
I go to see a sculpture that is very inspiring to me. Very beautiful sculpture. You'll love it.
Oh, right. You're asking us to fly to Oviedo and back?
No, we'll spend the weekend. I mean, I'll show you around the city, and we'll eat well, we'll drink good wine, we'll make love.
Yeah, who exactly is going to make love?
Hopefully the three of us.
Oh, my God.
I'll get your bill.
Jesus, this guy, he doesn't beat around the bush. Look, senor, maybe in a different life.
Why not? Life is short, life is dull, life is full of pain, and this is a chance for something special.
And that's our guest, Javier Bardem, putting moves on Scarlett Johansson and Rebecca Hall in Vicky Cristina Barcelona. You dog. Have you ever done anything like that in real life?
No way. Actually, I was shooting that scene and I said, who in the world is going to believe this? But Woody Allen did it right. I guess some people thought it was funny, and those two girls were crazy enough to do it.
Right, and then off goes romantic triangles, quadrangles, and mm-hmm. pentangles.
I think it's a great movie, and because it's really about, I was saying before, about the stereotypes, about the clichés, the Spanish cliché and the American cliché, actually, and the people behind those clichés, that basically we are all the same, we have the same fears, needs, and the way it's put together, I think it was very fun, but also very poignant, very, very, very... I'm very delightful to watch.
Right, and Penelope Cruz comes in a terrific mm-hmm. performance. Some people probably saw this as an antidote to the Anton Chigurh character, where you're this psychopathic killer in No Country for Old Men. Did you see it that way at all?
Not really. No. I don't have a plan. I don't have a plan in my head. I mean, things happen. Things have a meaning to you, and you do it. And there's no way that you can do a next step based on the previous one. That doesn't work that way, in my opinion. I mean, Woody Allen gave me this call. He showed me this. I thought it was going to be fun and great cast, Barcelona. And I said, well, why not? Let's do it. And once again, Woody Allen was shooting one take. So it's a different experience for 30 takes to one take. and no rehearsals. So it was kind of jumping off the cliff for me, because the scenes are very long and there's no cut. So it was like kind of challenging for me to be speaking with Woody Allen words that are jewels for the mouth. I mean, because for the language, for he writes so beautifully. But you only have one chance. So it was very challenging and also very, I don't know, rewarding.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how he was different from some of the great international directors you've worked with. That's one way. One take, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, one take and no rehearsal. And I don't know if I ever came to him and said I would like to speak of my character, but I think I did that and he looked at me like, I killed someone. Like, what? What is that? I said, no, don't worry. I won't bother you again.
Really? You just...
Yeah.
You give me your interpretation and it'll work, huh?
Exactly. He's one of those who said, I do the cast, and I do the cast because I know you can play it, so don't come to me and bother me with your method questions. But in a very funny way. And, of course, it's Woody Allen, so of course you say, of course, Mr. Allen, whatever you want.
You know, people who write about you comment a lot about your look, that you just have a compelling visual presence on screen. You have heavy eyes. Do you think about what you look like at all?
No. Well, I've been 20 once. And, of course, in that moment, I look at myself in the mirror trying to see what it was there. But I'm 42 now, so I don't think I look at the mirror, not even when I brush my teeth. So what I mean by this is that I can care less. What I try to do is to put my physicality into the character. And sometimes it's impossible. Sometimes it's easier. And sometimes it helps you to be on shape, actually. For Vicky Cristina Barcelona, I have to do a lot of sports and get on a diet, and that's good.
What's next for you?
Well, I've done this movie with Terrence Malick, which, once again, is a great honor for me to be in one of his movies. But because he's Terrence Malick, you never know what's going to happen. I may not be in the movie. I may not end up in the movie, but it was a great experience, and he's a very funny man, very smart. And now I'm reading some stuff, but I'm taking my time. I've always took my time. I've never rushed. Not in Spain when I started 22 years ago. I really want to read something that has some meaning to me, whatever the meaning is. And that's what I do, and that's something that I haven't changed in the way I look material.
Well, Javier Bardem, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Javier Bardem spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Bardem is nominated for an Oscar for his performance in the new film Beautiful, which is nominated for Best Foreign Language Film. In the past few years, several major museum exhibits have focused on the paintings of Titian, the artist many people regard as the greatest painter of the Italian Renaissance. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz counts it among his blessings that he's been able to see these shows, including the latest one, which includes two of Titian's acknowledged masterpieces in their first American visit. The exhibit, called Titian and the Golden Age of Venetian Painting, first opened in Atlanta and opens in Minneapolis on Sunday.
Titian was a painter's painter, a pure painter, not also a sculptor or an architect or scientist like Michelangelo or Leonardo. He created his ravishing images, often sexual, sometimes tragic, by pushing paint over a canvas, sometimes very large canvases, at a time when painting on canvas was still pretty new. Right now, two of Titian's very greatest paintings are in the U.S. for the first time. They're in a traveling show of Venetian masterpieces from the National Gallery of Scotland, which began last fall at the High Museum of Art in Atlanta. They'll be in Minneapolis until May 1st, and then they'll go to Houston. One reason I felt it was urgent to see them is that these two grand paintings are companion pieces, and there's a chance they may be permanently separated. The National Gallery of Scotland has had them on long-time loan from the Duke of Sutherland, but the Duke now wants to sell them. The National Galleries of Scotland and London have raised enough money to buy one of them at a good price, and they'll share ownership. But if they don't meet the Duke's deadline, the second painting could be sold at public auction, and probably at a price higher than most museums could afford. Paintings of this caliber and historic significance rarely come up for auction, where much lesser paintings have sold for staggering amounts. And these paintings are particularly special. In the 1550s, King Philip II of Spain commissioned Titian to paint a series of large canvases based on mythological subjects. The king seemed to have had a healthy libido, and Titian had his number. These two canvases are crowded with some of Titian's most voluptuous nudes. And now that I've seen them, I can testify that even more than with most paintings, reproductions do these no justice. They are radiant, luminous with rich reds and golds, pearl and creamy flesh tones. And they're extraordinarily moving, even scary. In the painting on the left, and the curators are pretty sure how they were intended to be hung, the young hunter Actaeon has stumbled upon the goddess Diana bathing at a fountain with her nymphs. He's at least as startled and as terrified as they are. Diana gives him a bone-chilling look. She's about to turn him into a stag, and the big, eager dogs that are his hunting companions will soon turn on him and tear him to pieces. In the far distance, in a mysteriously shimmering landscape, we can just barely make out a tiny figure, maybe Diana herself, chasing a stag. On top of a pillar in the grotto where the nymphs are bathing, there's a stag skull, and weird deerskins hang from nearby trees. The ominous present shares the canvas with its catastrophic aftermath. All time is eternally present, to quote T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. The companion painting is equally disturbing. Jupiter has fallen in love with Diana's nymph Callisto and raped her. She has tried to hide her pregnancy from Diana, who is not only a huntress, but also the goddess of chastity. In Titian's painting, because Callisto has refused to bathe with her companions, her sister nymphs are violently ripping off her clothes, while Diana watches imperiously. We see Callisto's swollen belly, and if we look close, we can see a small tear trickling down her cheek. It's one of the most poignant dabs of paint in Western art. "These are the tears of things," Virgil writes in one of the greatest passages of the Aeneid. There's no escaping the tragic fate inherent in all human life. Structurally, the two paintings are almost mirror images, and both paintings are full of bodies reflected in water. In the Actaeon painting, an actual mirror is a dazzling still life in itself. The painter Lucian Freud thinks these are the two greatest paintings ever painted. At the High Museum, I got into delightful and illuminating conversations with people who came even farther than I did to see these masterpieces. In fact, I hadn't noticed Callisto's heartbreaking tear until one of the other visitors pointed it out. In this traveling exhibit, there are 10 other paintings from the National Gallery of Scotland, including two small early Titians, two gorgeous Veroneses, a dramatic Tintoretto, plus 13 rare drawings. But no question about the main reason to see this show. I hope the British are able to raise the money to keep these two amazing works of art together, where they belong.
Lord Schwartz is the editor of the new centennial edition of Elizabeth Bishop's prose. He reviewed Titian and the Golden Age of Venetian painting that began at the High Museum of Art in Atlanta and continues at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts Sunday through May 1st. It moves to the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston later in May. You can see the two Titian masterpieces he discussed on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.